Okay, Boker Tov, everybody, Erev Tov. Welcome to the sixth of our six-part series of Touring the Land of Israel. And as Shuli was saying before, please God, some people, at least more people, can do these tours actually in person. So Vakasha, really a pleasure, and we look forward to continuing in the future at some point. And as we were just talking about, Shuli will begin our Tisha B'Av program at 11 a.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in Israel. She'll be speaking on the final days of the First Temple, but that'll be on Tisha B'Av. Today we're finishing our tours of Israel, and a pleasure to welcome and turn the mic over to Shuli. Thank you very much.
Okay, hi everybody. So today we are going to go up to the Golan, which is really one of the most beautiful parts of Israel. It is definitely appropriate for summer, talking about it in the summer, because this is where, this is Israel's playground. This is where everybody goes to get their dose of nature. It's one of the places that, one of the few places, unfortunately, that are still very much nature reserves and open areas. Part of that because of minefields that have not yet been cleared. That really is part of the reason. But we're going to try and explore a little of the Golan. And it's an integral region of Israel, right? It's a very important place in terms of the natural resources, in terms of the history. But in many ways, it's different than other places that we have been to in the last 5 weeks. Hey, we're going to talk about the geology and the topography. They definitely are different than a lot of other parts of Israel. They're very different. A volcanic plateau, not something we have in other places. And also the Jewish history is different. The history in general is different. We have a very large gap between the ancient history, where it's a very busy, thriving area, and the modern history, where it becomes thriving again. But we have a period of time of hundreds of years where it's really very empty and there's not much going on, not only Jewishly, but in general. Water here is very important. The military strategic importance of the Golan, we're going to talk about a little bit. The one place we're not going to talk about, even though it is in the Golan and it is very important, is the Hermon. And I left out the Hermon, the eyes of Israel, important place to know about, but we're going to leave it out of our discussion because we have plenty of other things to talk about. The Golan is 1,800 square kilometers, but only 1,200 of that is in Israel. We're going to see that the Golan has natural borders on the north, the south, and the west, but it doesn't have a natural border on the east, right? So it really kind of bleeds into Syria. Part of the Golan is still in Syria. And of course, the Golan was part of Syria between 48 and 67. So that brings us to our two maps, right? And the Golan, I guess we could say, has many more, but let's say two sides to it, right? Incredible natural beauty, very complicated human politics. So I brought these two maps to kind of emphasize that. The map on the right is something called the Golan Trail. Hey, people who know a little bit about hiking in Israel know that we have the Israel Trail, Shvil Yisrael, that goes through all of Israel from Metula to Eilat. And that was developed about 30 years ago, and it's become a real thing for Israelis, all different kinds of all ages that go, but particularly post-army, this is a thing to do, that you go do the Israel Trail before you head off to India and Peru and all these other places. But in recent years, there have been more trails because the Israel Trail is a beautiful trail, but it really only takes in the center of the country. So today there's a trail that goes through Judea and Samaria, for example, right? There are other trails that go in the Galilee. We spoke, I think, about the Sanhedrin Trail and the Gospel Trail. And this is a new, relatively new trail called the Golan Heights Trail, which is 120 kilometers starting from right below the Hermon, going all the way down to the Yarmouk River. We have such differences of landscapes in the Golan from 100 meters above sea level to 1500 meters above sea level. So you can imagine that this trail is both challenging. You start at the top and you go down, but you could do it the other way as well, right? But also just incredibly beautiful. My daughter did this a few years ago. It took her 5 days, right? 120 kilometers in 5 days. And you really get a sense of the landscape and the beauty and the human landscape, because people open up their homes and host the hikers. It's really amazing. Now take a look at the other map, right? On the left, political borders. Political borders, like we said, very complicated, because you do have natural borders, right? Let's understand the natural borders for a moment, right? The natural borders, let's just do this better. Okay. Natural borders are the Yarmouk River in the south here, right? On the west, very easy, right? The west is the Sea of Galilee is the natural border, and the Jordan River, right? In the north, sorry, not drawing very well. Okay. In the north, you have the Hermon. But in the east, you don't have a natural border. And that's why you could see these complicated ceasefire lines and mandate borders and French borders, right? All these things that changed over time. In 1949, the armistice lines are drawn with a demilitarized zone over here, right? This little green blob here, okay? Which Israel really tries to settle, and in some cases is successful, okay? But all the rest of the Golan Heights, and this includes Engev, by the way, but all the rest of the Golan Heights is under Syrian control. From the Six-Day War, it passes to Israel. We almost lose it 6 years later in the Yom Kippur War. So the political borders are very complicated. We'll come back to that a little bit towards the end. But first, let's understand some older history. Okay, so let's get our timelines done here. We have very important prehistoric settlement. We're going to go back even earlier than the Chalcolithic period, 6,000 years ago. We have earlier settlement, but I didn't put it on the timeline, but we will talk about it. Okay, but we have important settlement here 6,000 years ago in the Chalcolithic period. We have Canaanite settlement. Then when we get to Israelite times, right, when we get to First Temple times, biblical times, we have the Golan really being shared by two groups, right? You have Israelite tribes here. We're going to talk about the 2.5 tribes, Gad, Reuven, and half of Menashe. But you also have non-Jewish kingdoms here. You have the kingdoms of Geshur and Aram, which we have complicated relationships with, sometimes friendly, sometimes much less friendly, and we hear about that in Tanakh. In Second Temple times, hey, you have in the beginning mostly Hellenistic settlement, but by the second century of the Common Era, the Hasmoneans, the Hashmonaim come and they conquer, and we have Jewish communities. And in Second Temple times and later, this becomes a very dense Jewish settlement in the south and in the center of the Golan, not really in the north. And this continues throughout Roman times, Byzantine times, alongside pagan communities, Christian communities. All of this comes to a very abrupt halt with one of the most important dates in the history of the land of Israel. And we've talked about it in other parts of the country. And that's the huge earthquake in 749 CE. An enormous earthquake. We hear about it in literary sources. We see it in archaeology. There's a huge earthquake, and a lot of these communities just come literally and metaphorically crashing down, right? We don't have a lot of settlement. And this leads to a period of emptiness, nomads, lawlessness, and there's really not much going on. There's some settlements here and there. We have a fortress in the north, right? Nimrod's fortress, built by the Arabs, fighting over the area between the Arabs and the Christians, but not a lot of settlement. And it's only really in the late Ottoman period, in the 19th century, that people start to come back. And even then, Jews do not really come back. And Jews only start to come back after the Six-Day War. Okay, we have a little bit of attempts at settlement that are unsuccessful by Jews before the State of Israel, but mostly what happens is happening after the Six-Day War. So that's just to give us the bigger picture. In 1981, Israel unilaterally annexes the Golan Heights, not accepted necessarily by everybody in the world, but we say that it belongs to us. And some people may remember all the discussions that were going on in the time of Yitzhak Rabin and peace agreements that we were having with the Palestinians, right? And there were questions of, are we going to have a peace agreement and give the Golan to Syria? And many people had these stickers, Ha'avim HaGolan, right? The people is with the Golan. And you would see them all over the world. You go to Toronto, you'd see Ha'am Imhan Golan stickers, which I thought was kind of funny. But today, thank God that that never happened, because of the Syrian civil war would have been a complete disaster. And today the Golan is very much in Israeli hands. So let's go back to early days, okay? And to understand the geological formation of the Golan. Geology is not so much my thing, but you cannot talk about the Golan without talking about geology, because it is formed by volcanic eruptions. Okay, and if you look at this lovely map from the Ofra Field School, such a great map, just take a look and see, right? Here is our Ramat Golan, a volcanic plateau, okay? And that's why the Golan, by the way, is mostly, it's not completely, there are differences in height, like I said before, but it's a plateau. It's not really mountains as much as it is a heights, right? A high up above the Chula Valley, but there are these extinct volcanoes all along. There's a line of extinct volcanoes, which are called, in Hebrew, they're called tells, right? Tel Saki, Tel Fakhr. They're not tells, they're not archaeological mounds. They are volcanic, extinct volcanoes, but they get that name. And those are actually a very important security line that is used much later in the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War and today. The volcanic eruptions begin, the earliest ones are in the south, the latest ones are in the north. The earliest ones are 4.5 million years ago. The latest volcanoes are 120,000 years ago, which in geologic time is very recent, right? It's really not a long time ago. So the volcanoes are really what create the Golan Heights, and they have a very large impact, not just on the geology, but on a lot of other things as well, including water and soil and the type of things that can grow here. So the rock of the Golan, the main rock of the Golan, is the blackish grayish basalt. And that's when you see archaeological excavations in the Golan and ancient synagogues or churches, a lot of times things are made out of that black basalt stone, because that's the common stone that you find there. Okay. You have a few interesting phenomena from the volcanoes, right? So you have, take a look at this fabulous picture over here on the left. This is a picture of a mountain called Mount Avital, and it's a caldera. And you can see that it's a mountain, but there's like an open, empty space here. It's a volcano that has collapsed in upon itself, right? And you have these. You also have, this is Mount Avital, right? Right next door to Mount Avital is Mount Bental. Why? Because Avital is the father, is the Abba, right? It's the father volcano, and it erupted and created another mountain called Mount Bental, the sun, right? So you have the father and the sun right next door to each other. Like we said, we have these extinct volcanoes, this line of volcanoes that were used by the Syrians and then by the Israelis as military outposts, okay? The basalt seals up, is mostly sealed, so the water is conducted very well, and that's why you have a lot of springs in the Golan. You have a lot of waterfalls in the Golan, right? The water goes through the basalt and then emerges. Another interesting volcanic phenomenon is Birkit Ram, is this lake, right? This is a lake that is actually a volcanic crater, okay? It fills up with groundwater. It's in the north near Majd al-Shams. The big white mountain that you see in the background is the Hermon. Okay, and this was an important prehistoric settlement. Now, we have very early prehistoric settlement in the Golan. Okay? It's a fertile place, like we said, lots of water. There's a lot of, if you're interested in this stuff, there's a lot of fascinating new information that's coming out about prehistoric man in Israel. Okay? There was just discoveries in Ramla, in the center of the country, what they're talking about, a new, I don't know if species is the right word to use, right? But between Homo sapiens and the Neanderthals, there's a lot of interesting stuff that's coming out now. But we know that the Golan was one of the really earliest places of prehistoric man in the land of Israel. And this picture here on the right, which looks sort of like a blob of a rock, this is considered to be the oldest piece of art in the world. I know you're looking at it and you're saying that doesn't look like art, okay? But it's supposed to be a figure of a woman, okay? And you have to use a little bit of imagination, okay? But here's the head, here are her breasts, Okay. This is 250,000 years old. It's 250,000 years old. It's in the Israel Museum, and it is considered to be the oldest piece of art in the world. And it's found here in Birkat Ram. Art, ritual, it's a piece of rock that is carved in a particular shape for reasons unknown to us. Okay. So that's where we get into the realms of religion and art. Other more recent traces of the past, okay? The picture on the right is a picture of dolmens, okay? We have many, many of these, about 6,000 of these ancient tombs that have been found in the Golan. There are clusters in various places, in Gamla, in Yehudia. They're ancient tombs that go back about to the Middle Bronze Age, meaning about 4,000 years ago, okay? Canaanite, going back much further than the Israelites, okay? Going back to the time of the Avot, if to the patriarchs, if you want to think of it like that, okay? So we have these clusters in the Golan. We also have this strange thing, which you can see on the left. This is an aerial picture of a place called Ruje Mahiri. It's in the central Golan. It's near Moshav Yonatan, if that's a place that's familiar to you. It's people call it Israel Stonehenge, right? These are monuments that are about 5 meters tall. Because they're stone, it's not so easy to date them. Some people suggest they are from the late Bronze. What is it? Just like Stonehenge, nobody really knows. Is it meant to be some kind of a calendar, and a way to measure astronomy, some kind of a ritual site? We really don't know. But it is definitely something that goes back to ancient times, at least to Canaanite times, perhaps earlier than that. Let's get on footing that's a little bit more sure for us, and that's the Tanakh, okay? In Tanakh, we actually just read this, last week's Parsha, right? We have our 2.5 tribes, Gad, Reuven, and half of Menashe. While they are still in the, on the eastern side of the Jordan, they come to Moshe and they say to him, listen, we have lots of sheep and goats, and this is great grazing land. We want to stay here on this side of the Jordan. Now, of course, we have the very fascinating response of Moshe, which is, right? Your brothers are going to go out to war and you're going to stay here. They fought for you. You're going to abandon them. And this very, very strong rebuke that Moses gives them, that you have to go and fight for your brothers just like they fought for you. But after all that is over, they do stay on the other side of the Jordan. Okay, so we have Reuven, who is closer to kind of the center of the country, to Jerusalem, to Amman in Jordan. We have Gad, who is a little further north, but we have Menashe in the Bashan, and we hear about the Golan in the Bashan. That's where we hear about the word Golan, the name Golan, for the first time in Tanakh. Okay, and this is the area of Menashe. Now, fascinating, of the 6 cities of refuge, also last week's Parsha, okay, that Moses has to set aside, 3 of them are on the eastern side of the Jordan, right? And the commentaries actually talk about this. Does it mean that this is a more lawless place? It's a more empty place? Interesting suggestions, right? But we do hear about one of them in the Bashan, right? Moses set aside 3 cities on the east side of the Jordan to which a manslayer could escape, he could flee to one of these cities, Betzer, belonging to Reuven, Ramot in the Gilad, belonging to the Gad, and Golan in Bashan, right, belonging to Menashe. So that's up here. In the time of First Temple in biblical times, hey, like we said, part of the Golan is Israelite, but part of it also belongs to Geshur, to Aram. Okay, Aram is an enemy of the Israelites for about a century in the time of Eliyahu and Ahav. So this is where they are located. What happens to Israelite Golan? What happens is eventually what happens to the rest of the kingdom of Israel, and that is the Assyrians, right? The Assyrians come in here, they conquer here, they cross over the Jordan, and they conquer the rest of the north, and Jewish life is essentially extinct here, but it comes back, right? It comes back in Second Temple times, and that brings us to one of the most fascinating Jewish cities in the Golan, and that is Gamla, okay? Now, Gamla is most famous, okay? Gamla is in the southern part of the Golan. Gamla is most famous for the story of the resistance in the Great Revolt, right? The battles against the Romans. This is the final battle of the Jews in the north in the Great Revolt in the year 67 of the Common Era. There are battles all over the north in Yodfat, near the Kinneret, but the final battle in September of the year 67, in Tishrei 67, takes place in Gamla, and Gamla finally falls to the Romans, and that's the end of Jewish resistance in the north, and the Romans move to Jerusalem, right? Very appropriate for this time of year. But what's perhaps more interesting than the story of the battle, which is very interesting, is the story of the city, right? The city itself, because unlike Masada, right? Gamla sometimes gets the name Masada of the North. Unlike Masada, which was a fortress, right? It's Herod's palace fortress, and then the zealots come and use it. But Gamla is a thriving city, right? Gamla is a thriving city that exists already in Hasmonean times. And in it, we find not just fortifications and walls and towers and actual evidence of this final battle with the Romans, okay, weapons and breaches and all kinds of other things, but we find a thriving Jewish town, right? And what you're seeing in the picture on the left is kind of an aerial view of the whole town with the wall and the towers, okay, with some of the houses towards the top, but you're also seeing the synagogue, and that's the close-up in the picture here on the right. Gamla is one of the oldest synagogues that's discovered in the land of Israel. It's a synagogue from before the time of the destruction of the temple. And unlike Masada, which is a synagogue that's put in by the zealots when they come during the Great Revolt, the synagogue in Gamla is part of the community. It exists earlier, and we find mikvahs there, and we find all different kinds of things that indicate to us that Gamla is a Jewish town, right? Mikvaot, stone vessels, Hasmonean coins. We even find one of the most fascinating things that was discovered here, something that's discussed all over the Gemara, but we don't really find it in reality, and that's a lechi, right? This is a halachic way to make it possible to carry in an alleyway. Hey, it's used today as well when you create an Eruv in a city. It's discussed throughout Masechet Eruvin, but to find such a thing, right, an extra beam that's attached to the walls of an alleyway, it's not very common to find it, and we find it in Gamla. Hey, we'll tell a little more about Gamla as we go on. But let's understand the progression, first of all, of the Golan in late Second Temple times, and afterwards, it becomes a major center, right? We have a very interesting question, which is, after the destruction of the temple and the defeat of the Jews in the Great Revolt, was there a gap in settlement? Were there a couple of hundred years where nobody was living in the Golan? We know that later on, 3rd century, 4th century, and on, we have a lot of synagogues. But what about 2nd century, early 3rd century, were Jews living there? And the common knowledge answer was no. There was a gap in settlement. There was this terrible disaster of the Great Revolt. People left, and they only came back 100, 150 years later. But now, the more we discover, the more we're seeing that it seems that many communities did stay on, and there were even new communities that were created. And this is part of the story of archaeology that is still unfolding. But just take a look at this map, right? And this is a map from the year 2000. If I had a more updated one, which I don't think there is, unfortunately, there would be even more. But here's our Golan, right? This is a map of the synagogues that were uncovered up until the year 2000 in the Golan. Look at that huge concentration. And when we talk about Jewish life post the destruction of the temple, and certainly post the Bar Kokhba revolt, we often emphasize the area of the Galil, right? Moving up north. And of course, there is great Jewish settlement in the Galil and many important cities, Tveria and Sipori and Beit Shearim. But there's also perhaps more low-key but important Jewish life going on in the Golan. And we see this in all of the many, many synagogues that are discovered. Most of the Jewish communities in the Golan are in, as you can see in the map, the south, the center, okay? Not really in the north. Okay? What are they doing here? They are farmers. There's a lot of olive oil production. And they're Jews living a Jewish life. It's not a particularly, at least as far as we know, scholarly or important communities in the sense of having big, important names living there. It's just regular Jewish life. with people living their lives and putting their resources into large and beautiful synagogues. And we're going to see a few of them. So this one might be familiar to some people. This is the synagogue in the reconstructed Talmudic village of Katsrin. Hey, Katsrin is a fascinating place because not only did they find the ancient town and the houses and the beautiful synagogue, which is what you're seeing here, but they actually did something great. What they did is, based on the information that was found in Katsrin and in many other places, they recreated a house and a courtyard as it would have looked in Talmudic times, right? So anybody who's learning Mishnah, who's learning Gemara, who wants to understand what is a chatzer, what is a courtyard, right? What did a kitchen look like? What were the tools that people used, right? What did a wine press look like? Katsrin is an amazing resource to go to, okay? Another really fascinating Jewish site in the Golan, discovered much more recently, is a site called Umal Kanatir. It's also in the southern Golan. It's right near the modern Jewish community of Natur. El Kanatir is the Arabic name, Mother of the Arches. Okay, where does the name come from? If you go down to the town, which today has been reconstructed beautifully, it's really amazing what has been done there and the preservation, and it's a fascinating site. It's right above the Kinneret. And one of the distinctive features is these large pools, okay, with arches by them. And the question is this a ritual site? Is this an industrial, like, production site? Okay, this is a site that was only excavated in 2003. It was a thriving Jewish village. We're going to see the synagogue in a minute, that was completely destroyed by the earthquake of 749. Okay, now it's not the easiest place to get to. You have to climb down a hill. It's above the Kinneret. It's not super accessible. So unlike other places that people came later and used the stones and carted them away to build other things, Umal Kanatir was basically abandoned and left as it was. And that's why we're going to see the synagogue in a minute. Synagogue was able to be reconstructed almost completely from the original stones. What did they do? How did they make their money? So the archaeologists who excavated here, Yeshu Dre and Chaim Ben David, they say the pools here were used as a way to clean flax. Okay? Flax is used to make linen. Linen is a very, very valuable material. And these guys grew flax, cleaned it, sold it, and that's how they made their money in order to build the synagogue that we're going to see in a second. Just take a look at this pillar here. I love this pillar. And it's just a little detail, one of the things that was discovered in the synagogue. And it's got nothing very Jewish, just a nice drawing of a lion eating a sheep. Wouldn't you want a lion eating a sheep? Right here he is chomping down on his dinner right over here. It's just a beautiful little detail that you had in one of the many stones that are discovered here. So let's take a look at the synagogue for a second. This is an incredible synagogue because, like I said, everything was pretty much left in place. Now, because it was excavated pretty recently, okay, only in the last 15 years or so, they were able to use very, very modern technology. And what they did is every stone that they took out, they implanted it with a chip, with a computer chip that had all the information about where it was found, its dimensions, etc. Okay, and then they did something super cool. And you can understand this when you go to the site and go to the visitor center. They put all these chips into a computer program that essentially assembled them like a huge jigsaw puzzle and told the archaeologists where did the pieces go so that then they could reassemble it. In the picture here on the left, the special crane was used to put the pieces back together. And today you can go and see the synagogue almost as it was. It doesn't have a roof because roofs don't last, right? It doesn't have a roof, but it has all of the elements of the synagogue put back together almost completely from the original stones, right? Because almost everything was left in place. So it's really something that is worth seeing. One of the special features that the synagogue has, besides these interesting carved stones, has a lot of very elaborately carved stones. It has this piece here, which is called a hechalit. Okay. sort of like a mini bima, right? A place where you keep your Torah scrolls. And we know that there was an evolution in synagogue architecture where you would have, in the beginning, there the scrolls were kind of brought in and taken out, and there were movable arks. We even have a picture from Kfar Nachum, a stone inscription, a stone carving of an ark on wheels, right? That was brought in, it was taken out. But by the point that this synagogue is built, right? The synagogue is a little later, it's from the Byzantine period, you have a permanent ark. And this is one of the most elaborate ones. It has stairs going up to the top. It has these beautifully decorated pillars. So Om El Kanatir is really a gem in terms of synagogue architecture in the Golan. But moving from Jews, let's talk a little about Christians. Okay, right above the Kinneret in the south of the Golan, which we said was really a very Jewish area, but it wasn't only, you have this large city. This is a site that's not as well known because for many years it really was not very accessible. Today it's becoming more accessible. I actually went there for the first time just a few months ago, right before Pesach. I finally got there, and it's an amazing place. Okay? And it's called Hippos or Susita, which is the same name, right? Hippos in Greek, Susita in Aramaic. It both means a horse, right? And the idea is that it's a ridge that people say looks a little bit like a horse. Hey, it was a non-Jewish city, first a pagan city, then a Christian city. It's a very long-lived city. It lasts for almost 1,000 years, more than 1,000 years, from the 3rd century BCE to the 8th century CE. It's part of what was called the Decapolis, right? These 10 major Greek Roman cities, mostly on the eastern side of the Jordan, one Beit Shean on the western side of the Jordan. And it was a port, and it's a plateau above the lake, right? And you could see this beautiful major street, the Decumanus, the east-west street that you walk along, and you have this incredible, incredible view of the Kinneret. Churches were discovered there just recently, 2015. They discovered a large mask, a metal mask of the god Pan, who we're going to talk about, who is an important god in the Golan. Now, this place also, like we said, you have this combination of natural beauty and history with politics. Okay, so in the years between 49 and 67, this is in the DMZ. This is in the demilitarized zone between Israel and Syria. And Israel basically took it over, did some excavations here. It's a very strategic point because it's above the communities that are below, right by the Kinneret. So Israel used it by the IDF. The IDF used it until 1967. Today, because the Golan is all in Israeli hands, now it's just an archaeological site, but it does have a military, it had a military function as well. Now, to go back to Pan, right? If we go all the way up north in the Golan to the Banyas, right? So the northern part of the Golan, northwestern part, right? It's really on the edge of the Golan. There is a site called Banyas, which is really Panyas, right? Remember, Arabs cannot pronounce the letter P. So anything that is a P, we see this in our sources. It actually talks about Panyas. It got corrupted into the name Banyas. Okay? Now, Panyas was an important site that was holy to the god Pan, right? Remember Pan with the flute, rapes the women, not exactly a super sympathetic god, right? But he is a big god in the Golan, and you had a whole complex of temples to the god Pan in this area of the Banyas, which is, of course, an area that is full of water, okay? Banyas is one of the three sources, the three rivers that are the sources of the Jordan River. So there's a lot of water here, and probably the water is connected to the holiness of the site, right? And God, and Pan as a god of kind of partying and music, and the water is connected to that. We hear about Panyas or Banyas in our sources, right? One of the rabbis is asked, what is a sign when the Messiah is going to come? And he says, when the waters of Panyas turn red like blood, right? That's one of the signs that the Messiah is going to come. It's definitely a site that, despite its kind of very pagan nature, it is very familiar to Jews. And it's not only familiar to Jews, it's very familiar to early Christians. Okay. Herod, and then his son developed the site, and we have Herodian structures here as well. And they rename it Caesarea, but to kind of differentiate it from the other Caesarea. They call it Caesarea Philippi, okay? And this is a site that features very prominently in a story in the Gospels. And this is why when you go to Banyas, right, you'll see two different types of people there. You'll see Jewish Israeli tourists or you know, tourists from other places who are coming to see the water and the beauty of the water and check out the archaeology, but you will also see very devout Christian groups who come to read this story, right? What's the story? The story is very familiar. Not everybody knows that it happens in the Banyas. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? And the disciples give all sorts of wrong answers, right? Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, others say Jeremiah. What about you? He asked, who do you say I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah. Oh, you got the right answer, Simon Peter. You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, right? All the disciples get different names than their Jewish names, right? His Jewish name is Shimon. He calls him a Greek name, Peter, Petrus. And on this rock, I will build my church, right? This is the beginnings of the idea in Christianity of a church, of a pope. And it happens here in the Banyas. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And we will not go into the Christian theology here, but it's a very significant event in Christian history that happens here in the Banyas. So it's a pagan site that becomes a Christian site. If we go also in the north and a little further to the east, you'll get to one of the most phenomenal sites in Israel. If you haven't seen it, the next time you are up in the north, it is definitely something that is worth seeing. And this is Nimrod's fortress, right? It's a fortress that Mark Twain, actually, when he came here, you know, and he had a lot of disdain for the land of Israel and the Arabs that he met here and the Jews that he met here, but his breath was taken away by Nimrod's fortress because it's an incredible thing, right? It's this medieval fortress that still exists, right? Meters upon meters upon meters of the walls, of the towers. And if you go up to it today, there are excavations that have been done today and you can explore and you can see all the insides of the fortress and the secret passageways. And we'll talk about, you know, we'll see that in a minute. Who builds this, right? So this is the story of the area of the Banyas in medieval times, right? We said there's really kind of a cessation of settlement between the 749 earthquake and modern times, but it's not complete. This is clearly a strategic area. It's an important area. It's high up. It's got water. So people do want to control it, even if you don't have huge numbers of settlements. And in medieval times, you have battles between the Crusaders, right? The Christians coming from Europe and the Muslims over who is going to control this area of the Banyas. And at some point, this fortress is built that controls the whole area. Now, when this fortress was beginning to be excavated, originally people said, oh, this is Crusader, because we know about Crusader fortresses. Crusader fortresses are always built in this massive way, high up, right? A site that has a view of the whole area, so you can really control the whole area. It fits beautifully with everything we know about Crusader fortresses. However, it's not. Okay, it was actually built by the Muslims. Okay, it's first built in 1228 by somebody named Al-Aziz Othman, Saladin's nephew. Okay, and it gets an Arabic name called Kal'at Subeba, the castle on the cliff. Okay, then we found other inscriptions like this one over here, Arabic inscriptions that talk about Sultan Baybars. Okay, Baybars is the Mamluk ruler who defeats and drives out the Crusaders from the land of Israel. So we found that. We found earlier Arabic inscriptions, and it seems clear that even though this seems to recall Crusader fortresses, this is actually an Arab fortress, right? Arab fortress first built by the Ayyubids, then added to by the Mamluks. And it's truly an awesome place. It's got underground water reservoirs. It's got secret passageways. It's got toilets. It's got everything you would want for a great site. If you want to go on really an incredible journey, go up north in the summertime and they do nighttime lantern tours of this fortress. Oh, super cool. Okay, so that's Nimrod's fortress, very worth visiting. But let's get to more modern times, okay? So basically what we said is that the Golan is largely abandoned for centuries upon centuries. in the 19th century, as archaeology is beginning as a discipline, and you have the very famous Palestine Exploration Fund, all of these British archaeologists and surveyors who come to the land of Israel and explore, people like Charles Wilson and Charles Warren, they don't come to the Golan. Right? The Golan is kind of far away, off limits. But there are some scholars who do come to the Golan. And you have this duo here, these two very unusual fellows. Gottlieb Schumacher is the one on the left here. He's a German Templar who has a house in Haifa. And he brings along with him the fellow in the middle, Lawrence Oliphant, who is Bichlal, a very strange fellow. He's a Christian Zionist. He has a house in the Carmel, in Daliat al-Carmel. Very, very interesting fellow. But the two of them go and they do a survey of the Golan. And they're actually the first ones to discover Umm el-Qanatir that we mentioned before. And Lawrence Oliphant writes a whole a book about life in the Golan and what they discover with all these drawings, with all these pictures. It's clearly not an archaeological excavation, but it's a survey, right? This is stuff that you should look for. But it takes a long time till that really happens. And that's the picture of the gentleman on the right. Right? This is Shmaryahu Gutman. Now, post-1967, right, this happened in a lot of places. Israel suddenly came into the possession of land that we never really had in our control in modern times. And this was land that we knew had lots of history. So there was a decision to do large scale surveys, right? There's a very large one that's done in the Shomron, and there's one done in the Golan, meaning not excavations, surveys. Let's take a look and see what we can find so that we know what to excavate later. And Shmaryahu Gutman and Yitzhak Igal, they do a large survey post-67 of the Golan. And one of the things that they are aiming to find is Gamla. Okay, we know about Gamla from Josephus. Josephus tells us the story of Gamla. It's a great story. And not only does he tell us the story, I'm going to go back to the picture of Gamla for a moment. Sorry to make you dizzy. He not only tells us a story, but he tells us a little bit about what Gamla looks like. And he says it's this high mountain with steep sides, with cliffs overlooking the Kinneret. And it has its name, Gamla. Remember Susita, because it looks like a horse. Gamla looks like a camel. It looks like a gamal. It looks like a camel's hump. Okay, so armed with this information from Josephus, Shmaryahu Gutman and Yitzhak Igal go in their survey trying to find Gamla. And Yitzhak Igal comes one day and he says, I found this mountain and it really looks like a camel. And they come back the next day, the two of them with a group of volunteers, and they start to hike down the hill. Even today, I mean, today there's a road that you have access to, but a lot of people will hike there. And they start to hike down the hill, and Shmaryahu Gutman says to the group, whoever finds the first coin, right, he's the winner. He gets the prize. And they get down to the bottom, and really, within a few minutes, they find a coin from Hasmonean times, right? It's just amazing. There are thousands of coins that were found around Gamla, but this is a coin from Alexander Yanai, from one of the last Hasmonean kings. This is clearly a town that goes back to Second Temple times. And then they have to decide, okay, where are we going to dig? Now, they find the remains of the wall. It doesn't look like this. It's much more covered up. But they do find, starting to protrude out of the ground, bits of a wall that they follow. And they have to decide, where should we start to excavate? And they choose a piece of the wall that has the nicest looking stones. And they figure they'll start to excavate there. And they made a very good choice, because this is where the synagogue is. They chose to excavate and they found the synagogue. Now, this is a back-breaking excavation. There was no road when they start to excavate here in the late 60s. And they have to schlep everything down by hand, all the way down the mountain, schlep everything out by hand. But it's an incredible, incredible excavation. And one of the things that they find that is truly extraordinary is they find very crudely minted coins that say Ligi'ulat Yerushalayim, for the redemption of Jerusalem. Meaning the fighters in Gamla and the Great Revolt are not just fighting for the Galilee, and they're not fighting for the Golan, and they're not fighting for their homes. They're fighting for Jerusalem and the temple in Jerusalem. So Shmaryahu Gutman describes this discovery in very emotional terms. It was really a very powerful thing for him. He died a few years ago, but describing this, finding it and being taken back to Second Temple times by what they discovered there. Now, let's go more to modern times. Okay, before the Six-Day War, the Golan Heights is in Syrian hands. And we already saw, right, the Golan is a plateau. It is above the Chula Valley. Between 48 and 67, Chula Valley, of course, is in Israeli hands. The Golan Heights is in Syrian hands. And that creates many, many problems. Okay? Problem number one, much of the source waters of the Jordan River are in or close to Syrian hands. And in fact, in the 60s, the Syrians attempt to divert the Banias water so that it will flow only into Syria and none of it will flow into the Jordan and none of it will get to Israel. And this causes a lot of conflict. Okay? So this issue of the water is a very big potential problem. The other issue is the issue of the safety of the residents and the farmers and the school children of the Chula Valley, because they are sitting ducks underneath the Golan Heights. And there are attacks, sniper attacks, all the time, randomly. Now, when the Six-Day War breaks out, in June of 67, the first 4 days of the war are focused on Egypt and the Sinai, right, and taking out the Egyptian Air Force before it can attack, focused, of course, on Jerusalem and on Judea and Samaria. But the final 2 days of the war, okay, actually already on the fourth day of the war, the residents of the Galilee petition the government, okay? They go to Jerusalem and they say, they go to Levi Eshkol, we want you. The momentum is continuing, right? In the beginning of the Six-Day War, it's unclear how Israel is going to fare. It's very, very frightening in the beginning. But by the fourth day, thank God, it's very clear that Israel is doing well. And they say, this is your chance. This is your opportunity. Take the Golan from Syria. Give us our security now. Okay. The commander in the Galil, the commander in the north, Dado Elazar, comes, he asks for approval for the attack. Miriam Eshkol, who is Levi Eshkol's wife, tells him, I want the Banias for my birthday. Right? And on the fifth day of the war, they attack in the Golan. The fifth day is very intense, very difficult fighting. But by the sixth day, it's very clear that they can take the Golan. But there's a fear that the United Nations is going to call a ceasefire. So what do? They take every available body in the IDF, including cooks, right, including truck drivers, and they send them to sit on the hills in the Golan to say, we have taken this hill, so that by the time there is a ceasefire, Israel has taken the Golan. The Syrians flee already on the sixth day of the war. The Syrians flee. They leave everything behind, right? Bunkers, trenches. People have told me, I heard an amazing story from somebody who said he toured in the Golan literally like a month or two after the war was over. And they went into one of the bunkers and they found Syrian maps that were left there. Like they just picked themselves up and they ran. Who stayed behind? The Druze and the Circassian Arabs who were there, they stayed behind. We'll get to the Druze story in a minute. But the picture that I'm showing you here besides the map, this is from a place called Mitzpeh Gadot, which is you drive up to the Golan from the Galilee. You can stop on the side of the road. There's a memorial here. You can go, you can see the bunkers, the Syrian bunkers that were here. And you can see this great inscription, right? This is something that was said by Dado Elazar when he was taken on a tour of the Golan Heights after the war was over. And he said to the settlers of the Chula Valley below, he says, Mikan atem nir'im gdolim shivataim. From here, you look 70 times bigger, meaning you had so much courage to stay there down in the valley as the Syrians were up here above. Okay? And there is... there is some security that is given to the residents of the valley once the Golan is conquered. Now, we'll come back to that story of security of 67, of 73, but just a short diversion to the story of Eli Cohen. Eli Cohen's story has become much more well-known in the past couple of years. There was a Netflix movie about him. There were a few things that were about him, but he was already a hero who was known before. The famous book about him is called Our Man in Damascus. There are many myths about Eli Cohen, but the true story is amazing enough that you don't need myths. Eli Cohen was a Sephardi Jew. Okay, who obviously, because he came from Arab-speaking countries, he spoke Arabic, he looked more like an Arab than Ashkenazi Jews, and he volunteers to be a spy. And he is sent on a very, very sensitive mission to Syria. Okay, this is in the early 60s. We need to go know what's going on in Syria. And he goes, first he travels to Argentina, where he reinvents himself. He creates a new identity as an Arab businessman. Okay. And from there, with this new identity, he goes to Syria and he becomes the toast of the town. Okay? He manages to get in with all of the VIPs, not just on a business level, but on a political level, on a military level. And he gets taken everywhere, including to the Golan. Now, what you have to understand is between 49 and 67, the Golan is a closed military zone. Everyday Syrian citizens cannot go there. Only the army can go there and VIPs who have connections. Okay? But Eli Cohen is taken to the Golan Heights as a VIP. And he goes to Hamat Gader and he goes to all these outposts. And this is a picture of him in the middle where he's there with his, you know, with his Syrian friends. Now, of course, what he does is he passes information to Israel about where the Syrian outposts are and what are the Syrians doing there and what are the troops like, information that proves vital in 1967. Now, the most famous story about Eli Cohen is almost without a doubt not a true story. And that's the story of the eucalyptus trees, which is that Eli Cohen told the Syrians, oh, you know that in your bunkers to have shade, you should really plant eucalyptus trees because they'll give you shade and it'll be much more comfortable. And then he told the Israelis, wherever you see eucalyptus trees, that's what you should bomb. It's not a true story because trees don't grow that fast. Eli Cohen is killed in 1965. It wouldn't be likely that you would have such tall trees. But what he did, he doesn't need extra stories. What he did was incredible. Very, very tragically, in 1965, he had become careless. He had began to broadcast at the same time of day, every day, you know, getting on the radio to his connections in Israel. And he's caught and he's dragged through the streets and he's publicly hanged in 1965. It's a terrible story. And from 1965, by the way, Israel has been trying to get his body back and the Syrians have refused and he's still there buried in Syria. Today in his memory, there are a lot of things in his memory, but one of the really neat things that was done is you can travel on what's called the Eli Cohen Trail in the Golan, which is a series of places that tell stories of places that he went to, where he went to Hamat Gader, or other places. And one of the stops has this sculpture. They all have interesting sculptures. This is a sculpture of Eli Cohen with a few different faces, right? A face facing to Israel, a face facing to Syria. He's a spy. He has to live a double, sometimes a triple life. So amazing, amazing story. And somebody whose information was vital to Israel in the Six-Day War. Now, the story of the Golan is not just the story of 1967. It's also the story of 1973. In 1967, there's incredible, incredible success. We actually make it all the way to Quneitra, which is the picture over here on the left, the Syrian city of Quneitra. There are attempts to have Jewish settlement here. It doesn't quite work. But in the following years, there's a sense of complacency, right? And this is a very logical thing. There's this incredible success in the Six-Day War, and therefore there's a denigration. Oh, the Arabs, they don't know how to fight. They're not good fighters. They don't have any good intelligence. And Israel slacks off. So that in 1973, as the Syrians are really stockpiling their weapons and advancing towards the border, the intelligence is ignored and ignored and ignored. And of course, very famously on Yom Kippur, on the day of Yom Kippur itself, the Syrians advance, and in the first few days they reach almost to the Kinneret, and the entire is not only the Israeli settlement venture in the Golan is threatened, but Israel is threatened, right? The Galil is threatened, and it's very unclear in those first few days if we're going to survive. And there are many unbelievable stories from that time, people who were caught up there, people who had to escape. The rabbi of our community, Rav Weitman, was a young yeshiva student. And the yeshiva students were sent up to daven for the soldiers. They were sent to blow shofar and to lead the Yom Kippur services. And he was caught in the Golan behind Syrian lines. And he escaped by foot to go down to the Kinneret. His family had no idea where he was for days at a time. So it was a very, very difficult period. It was very unclear whether we would hold on. And really, the story of the Yom Kippur War is the story of the valiance of the ordinary soldiers, right? Ordinary soldiers who stepped up in an incredibly courageous way, fought on, and managed to hold on to the Golan. And we have a couple of amazing stories I'll just tell very briefly. One of them is the story of Tel Saki. I remember we said that line of volcanoes called Tells. This is the southernmost one. And these are a group of soldiers, 20-year-old soldiers. The commander was 20. They were younger. Commander is Menachem Ansprecher. These are religious soldiers who were brought up here for Yom Kippur, like I said, to pray for the soldiers who are here. And they are surrounded by Syrian tanks and they have to hold out. And other survivors come there. And finally, the Syrians advance and they come. And one of the soldiers, Yitzhak Nagarker, volunteers to go out and to surrender to the Syrians to tell them that everybody inside is dead. And by doing so, he saves everyone. People who may have watched, there was an amazing TV show, Israeli TV show this year called Sha'at Ne'ilah. And a lot of it was about this particular story. Another incredible story is the story of the Valley of Tears, Emek HaBacha. This is Avigdor Kahalani. He was the tank commander of Brigade 77. There were 45 Israeli tanks up on the ridge in this area, and there were 500 Syrian tanks. 45 against 500. Okay? The battle went on from the morning of October 7th until October 10th. Okay? Avigdor Kahalani, with his 45 tanks, many of which are hit, destroys 130 Syrian tanks. At the end, he has 6 tanks left of his own, and he just keeps encouraging his soldiers, you have to hold out, reinforcements are going to come, reinforcements are going to come, and they do, and they hold out. So the Yom Kippur War is really a story of the ordinary soldier against all odds, holding on. Jewish settlement begins already in July 67. Okay? First community is Marom Golan. That's the picture that you see here on the left. This is the picture of the shelter, right? They still needed shelters. They're still in a very dangerous area. By 1973, there are 15 communities. The women and the children are evacuated during the Yom Kippur War, but of course they come back. Today, there are 33 Jewish communities. There are 23,000 Jews who live on the Golan. We're going to talk about the Druze population in a minute. There's only one city. It's a very small city. It's called Katrin, and that was established 10 years later in 1977. That's the picture you see over here. We also have a Druze community. Okay, now the Druze are fascinating. We have a Druze community in the rest of Israel, right, in the Carmel. The Druze are loyal to the country that they live in. They've always been persecuted by the Muslims, so they are always loyal to their country. And the Druze in Israel, they're drafted into the army. The Druze in the Golan are in a much more sensitive position because they have family that is in Syria. They've been basically split between the two countries. And so they are much more kind of cautious about their allegiances. They have permanent resident status. They are offered citizenship, but most of them refuse to take it. With the Syrian civil war, they started to take it more and more, but you still have Druze families that are split between the two countries. And the picture in the middle here is of a bride being brought from Syria to the Golan to marry into one of the Druze families in the Golan. But the Druze in the Golan are very, very friendly to Israel. They're very loyal to Israel, but they are in this complicated position. Okay, finally, a few things about nature. Hey, water. Water is an incredibly important resource in the land of Israel and in the Golan as well. We said one of the main water sources of the Jordan, the Banyas, is located in the Golan. We also get the snow melt coming from the Hermon. So holding on to the Golan is very significant for Israel's water. Today, we have not just these water sources, the springs and the banyas and other things. We also have reservoirs. Right? Israel did something very smart. Instead of allowing all the rainwater in the Golan to flow down to the Kinneret and then be pumped back up to be used in the Golan, Israel built 15 reservoirs on the Golan. These are seasonal reservoirs. They fill up in the winter, and they are used by the residents of the Golan. Okay? Another important energy resource is wind. Okay. In 1992, 20 years ago, the May Eden factory, the water factory, built a wind turbine farm. think that's the right term, right? In the eastern part of the Golan, on a mountain called B'nai Resen, and it provides enough energy for the Me'eden factory, for the Golan Heights winery, and for 20,000 residents of the Golan. So it's really an incredible resource using wind power. And another strange natural phenomenon is hot springs. Okay? The picture that you see here is Hamat Gader. It's a natural hot spring. Already 2,000 years ago in Roman times, there is a spa here, okay? Bathhouse, hot springs. There's a synagogue here. There's a Jewish community here in ancient times. Today, it has become a resort center, but it's still the same hot springs from thousands of years ago. And finally, the Golan is known for its agriculture, all kinds of amazing agriculture, from the classics like apples and olives and grapes to all kinds of very interesting new experimental, right? Different kinds of berries and cherries that don't grow so much in the rest of the country, kiwis, papayas, all over the place. Wine, of course. Okay, the first boutique winery in Israel is in the 80s in the Golan Heights Winery. That's the first that's not Carmel, that's not like Kiddush wine, but really they brought in a viticulturist from California to develop much more fine wine. Today there are vineyards in all the regions of the Golan. And we said that because of the soil and the climate, that it's very unusual. You can grow all different kinds of grapes. And there are more than a dozen different boutique wineries. Today, the Golan Heights Winery is not even considered a boutique winery. It's too big. It's too much mass production. But there are all these small wineries. If you're into wine, wine tour the Golan Heights, right? But could also go and see nature, right? And this is what Israelis associate the Golan with more than anything. The place where you go to see waterfalls, to go on incredible hikes, right? A lot of springs, the Zavitan and the Yehudia, one of the most amazing, beautiful natural phenomena. You can see it in the picture on the left here. This is called the Mishushim Pool, Mishushim as in hexagons, okay? From the word shesh, six. Okay? These are naturally created hexagonal rocks, right, that are made by volcanic eruptions. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And animals, because there are not that many people in the Golan, right? About 23,000 Jews, about the same equivalent number of Druze. So 47,000 people, that's not so much for such a large area. There are a lot of places that are kind of off limits, whether because of mines or they are nature reserves. And so there are a lot of animals. Okay? Just to give you an idea, the same number of cows as of Jews in the Golan, 25,000 cows in the Golan, raised on all kinds of ranches. There are even some wild cows. Okay? There are boars, there are wolves, and there are these majestic birds called vultures, which in Hebrew is a nesher. A nesher is not an eagle. It's a vulture, and it's an incredibly beautiful bird. Today in danger, not extinction, but not doing super well, unfortunately, because vultures eat carrion. And the ranchers in the Golan sometimes will put out poison for the wolves because they don't want the wolves to come and attack the cattle. The wolves eat the poison. They die. The vultures come and eat the wolves, right? And this is a terrible thing because we don't want this species to become extinct. So today there are more and more attempts to preserve the Nesharim. If you go to Gamla, there's a whole Nesher information center, and they really are majestically beautiful creatures. And cows and horses, because they're so pretty. Okay, let's see what questions and comments. So many. Let's take a look. What do we have here? All right, let's go back up to the top. Yes, stickers from the Golan. Right, the lava flow. Golan Shalanu Tamid. Yes, we have a couple of those good propaganda songs. Why does Menashe get so much more land? That's an excellent question. You could answer it on a Tanakh level, which is that they are a very large tribe. You could answer it on a more kind of academic level, that there are tribes that are more powerful than others. And Menashe is definitely one of those foundational tribes. They have a lot of land on the other side as well, but they are clearly a very significant tribe. That is an interesting point. Gamla is Yoshua ben Gamla. He's the guy who makes the public schools, but that's so interesting that you made that connection. Gamla is shaped like a gamal, exactly. So cool, some of them worked. excavating in Gamla. So nice. Ein kshatot, exactly. Uma kanatir is ein kshatot. Susita was a failed Israeli car model. I don't know what that means. Is pagan still a usable term? We are much less PC in Israel than you guys are. So we say whatever we're allowed to say. I don't know if that's what you meant. Panic. Yes, exactly. Right. Pan. Look up Pan. Not a very sympathetic character. The Crusader fortress of Montfort is in the Galil. Okay. It's not in the Golan. You are thinking of Nimrod. Nimrod is right near the Banyas, but Montfort is an amazing Crusader fortress in the Western Galil. Whoever wrote me privately, please write me privately in the email, and I would love to respond to you. Yes, they were reluctant to take the Golan Heights. A lot of the story of the Six-Day War is reluctance. They're reluctant to take Jerusalem as well. You have to understand that before the Six-Day War begins, it's unclear if Israel is going to survive the Six-Day War, God forbid. And so moving further and doing more and angering the world, we're always very cautious about those things. 70 times or seven. Sorry, I don't remember what that's about. You'll write me later. Eli Cohen, it is a great story. It makes me sad, but really there's enough true stuff that we don't need to tell things that are not. My neighbor down the street was in one of those six tanks. Wow. Unbelievable. Should definitely get the story. Have him come and speak, Rabbi Kalman, if he's willing to. Yes, there's definitely danger of having the Jewish communities in the Golan, of course. And then when you drive in the Golan, by the way, there are certain roads that are very narrow that have barriers that are meant to stop tanks from coming down to the Kinneret. We learned our lesson from the Yom Kippur War. Troops were already moving to the north by Wednesday, June the 7th. Yes, it's not that they weren't thinking of doing it. They just didn't make the full decision. Wow, that's so cool. I was doing a junior year at Hebrew U and spent the first few days of war in the Galil. Wow. Yes, the Banyas. Thank you, everybody. Brechat HaMishushim. Oh, that's a very bad story. I'm sorry to hear that. Any other? Thank you, all the thank yous. Oh, okay. Ask Rabbi Jonathan Ziering. That's a good idea. Okay, Rabbi Kalman, we have a desire for a live tour. Bring everybody to Israel.
Emirat Hashem. We're still not allowed in, as you know.
But, I know. It'll change at some point.
Hopefully, yeah. We look forward. But in the meantime, we'll have to continue virtual tours. We'll see when, how. But thank you. We really want to thank you for another wonderful series. Always a pleasure. And I think by the amount of people and the interest and the questions and the comments, people are most appreciative. And really, we can't be there in person. At least we can be there a little virtually. And the combination, your knowledge, the pictures, the excitement you bring to the class. You know, you talk 100 miles a minute, which I love. And you know, all the information you wanna pack in and present it in such a beautiful, clear way. So I want to thank you on behalf of everybody, and we look forward. On Tisha B'Av, we're not going to be so, you know, we're not going to give introductions and all thanks yous. It's a different style. But as we mentioned at the beginning, Shuli will be kicking off our Tisha B'Av program 11 a.m. Eastern on Sunday morning. And her talk will be the final days of the first Beit HaMikdash. And we'll have programming from 11 till 7:15. So that's all day. And in 10 minutes, Rabbi Jonathan Ziering will do part two of his series on Shemitah. Yes, you can ask him all questions you want. He's very good. He knows, he'll know the answer. And he'll be talking today on who has the final say in rabbinic and biblical law, basically overturning. When do we have the power to change laws? That will be today at 12:15. This evening at 8:30, Rachel Sletsky, who is finishing up her PhD at Harvard in comparative religion and holds the Isidore Twersky Fellowship at Harvard. She'll be giving our Parsha Shiur at 8:30 p.m., 3:30 a.m. in Israel. This evening, tomorrow, I'll have my regular Pirkei Avot Shiur at 9:30, and then we'll see you, please God, on Tisha B'Av. And thank you very much, everybody. Go get a cup of coffee. I won't be able to say that on Sunday, but I can say it today, and we'll see you back, please God, at 12:15, same Zoom channel. Just stay right here, and I'm sure you'll learn much. A very different style, a different topic, different thing about Rabbi Zirin, but also relating, of course, to Israel, this year being a Shemitah year. Okay, thank you very much, you know, Shuli, and we'll see you just before 11 or 6 p.m. on Sunday. Have a meaningful fast, easy fast, and all the best. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Shabbat Shalom.
Shuli, it's amazing about the history you find and how well you present it. Thank you so much. All the best.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. I love doing this series. So we will do another one, Bezrat
Hashem. And we love having it.
Amen. For
thank
sure.
you.
Okay. We'll see you all soon in a few minutes.
Hey, thanks so much. Thanks, Shuli. Thanks, Jay. Take care.